This is Startups for Recipes, episode 143. Welcome to Startups with Recipes, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it, I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
It's been a good week. The very first dollar came through for Drip this week. And
congratulations. We should have like applause music or something like that.
Yeah, it feels good. It feels like another milestone. I think there are 15, 16 users in the system now. And there's about a third of them that are really super engaged and are, you know, have already paid. So revenue's in the, I don't know, it's about $250-$300 right now. And that feels really good to have that down. And then another third are still getting set up. Probably just got them onboarded in the last couple of days. And so they're working on it. And then there's another third that I'm working with. They've been on for a week or two, but they're still working on, you know, struggling to get their mini course set up and kind of getting the time for their team to create it. But it's been, as always, been a fantastic learning experience. And I love hitting milestones like this because it just keeps me and Derek motivated to move forward because it feels like, you know, we're making progress.
Now, are you billing people as soon as they sign up, or you got like a 14-day trial period for them?
Yeah, at this point, it's everything is manual. And so I'm, you know, it's still early access. I haven't even emailed the main list. And so I'm basically working one-on-one with people via email and sometimes via video Skype. And once they get set up, then I monitor their account and I email them and say, hey, you know, are you happy with the results? Are you happy with the conversions? And there's been like one guy's been set up for 3 or 4 weeks, but he's not getting the conversions he's looking for. And so he and I are kind of working out how he can improve that. And it's not until he sees value in it that I'm going to bill. And I email everyone before I bill them and I say, hey, are you getting enough value out of it to pay $49? You know, and then I get their credit card info and do it from there. So it's totally one-off, totally manual. At this point, I really wouldn't have it any other way. You know, before we email, I have 100 or 200 people I'll be emailing. And before we do that, that's when I'll need to get a trial in place. And I won't bill them up front, at least to start. I really think that they need to see some value in it before, you know, they get billed.
Yeah, I'm working through the some of the sign-up code for Audit Shark right now. I'm kind of last week I was complaining about how everything just seemed like it fell apart,
right.
And over the past 7 days, I've really gotten things so that everything's back together again, and it actually is solid now. So I don't think that things will fall apart in the way that they did before. Part of it had to do with code merges. I found that there was some code that had been merged in, and it broke some things. So I've got most of that straightened out, and there's a few last-minute tweaks that I need to get, you know, straightened out. In terms of the sign up for the early access, I'm really close to having that all squared away and then, you know, touching base with a few people and have them sign on. And when to bill them is actually a question I kind of had in my mind. I was kicking it around a little bit to try and figure out, you know, do I bill them up front or do I wait a little bit? And I think I'm going to hold off a bit. You know, I'll take their credit card information and stuff as part of the sign up process because that's already in there, but I probably won't bill them, you know, for a couple of weeks. I'll just kind of give it some time, let them see what they're getting out of it, get some of the feedback that I need to make the tweaks, and then, you know, touch base with them just the way that you did in terms of saying, hey, you know, is it all right if we switch over to start to bill you?
Right. And that was the cool part is when I emailed folks, you know, most of the people who I emailed, I only emailed because I knew that Drip was working for them and that they're actively using it and they're getting subscribers and conversions and all that. And it still feels weird, you know, it still feels weird to email someone and say, hey, can I bill you $49? Or one guy's actually on the mid-tier plan. So can I bill you $149 for the next month of usage? And all of them, like when they came back, it felt really good. They were like, absolutely, this is, you know, definitely worth it. And it's like, it gives you that rush of adrenaline of like, we're really doing something that works here. I've enjoyed this approach. I think trying to make an arbitrary trial length this early in the game or to bill people up front when they're basically, they're not doing you a favor per se, but kind of, right? It's going to take a little more time than just signing up for a traditional service. I think that's probably premature right now. Today, we're going to be talking about how to hire like a bootstrapper, and we actually have a guest, Laura Roeder. So today, Mike and I have the pleasure of having Laura Roeder on the show. She's calling in all the way from London. So Laura, we appreciate, you know, the last minute scheduling and the fact that you're, what, 8 or 10 hours off of us.
Yes, super, super happy to be here. You even recorded it during the daytime for me instead of the middle of the night, which is very nice.
So Laura is an expert. She's a social media and personal brand building expert. She was a 2012 MicroConf attendee. And she is here today to talk about how to hire like a bootstrapper. And in typical Startups for the Rest of Us fashion, this will be much less of an interview and more of a panel discussion as Mike and I pipe in with our experiences as well. Laura brings a unique viewpoint on this topic because she's a non-technical person who has hired technical people. And so we're going to look at elements of how that was difficult or challenging for her. Laura has been on, she's appeared on Mixergy twice. She's, all over the press, Forbes.com, CNET, LA Times, Fast Company. She's had a course on AppSumo. She also runs, and I think, Laura, correct me if I'm wrong, this is where you kind of got your experience of hiring, is you have a membership website called Social Media Marketer, and then you have a course on creating, it's called Creating Fame, which is more of a personal branding course. Is that where you got your initial experience hiring folks?
Yeah, I have a team that helps me run the business, and the business is those two courses.
Very cool. All right, so we have an outline that Laura has graciously provided, and we're going to kind of start popping through a few of these points. The first item we're going to talk about is how hiring or outsourcing is different for a bootstrap startup versus a funded one. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of bootstrappers are completely and totally overwhelmed, especially with how to do their first hire, because traditionally when you look at hiring, you kind of look at the team you need and then you look at your budget, how much can we afford for everybody? And a bootstrapper, your budget is zero, you know? And you're often thinking, I know I thought this in the beginning, well, I can't afford $60,000. I can't even afford $30,000 to pay someone a yearly salary. So how can I have anyone? And I think that bootstrappers have to get a lot more creative in how they hire, because you don't have that. You never have $500,000 in the bank that you can just use to pay people huge salaries. You often never get to that point as a bootstrap business. You're just going little bit by little bit.
Right. And what's interesting about that, I remember hearing Peldy talk about it early. He said he was questioning when to hire that first person. And he said he waited until he had 6 months of that person's salary in the bank before he would hire them, because it just made him feel more comfortable that he wasn't basically going to have to let somebody go so quick. And so you can imagine how much slower his growth was than someone who, as you said, had $500,000 or $1 million in the bank to do it.
I think that's great if you can get there. I certainly have not been at that point for most of my business. And also, if you're starting out hiring freelancers, they kind of know, and it can be good motivation. Like, we need this work to work out so we can keep the business growing and so we can keep paying you more,
Right. So what, have you had a rule of thumb for yourself, or do you just, when you need the help, if you have, $1 more than the project, then you'll hire a freelancer?
Yeah. I mean, I guess my only rule of thumb is just always to put money towards hiring first. I think a lot of people are willing to do things like spend a bunch of money going to conferences or buying like training of various sorts, but they won't actually spend money hiring people to do the things they're learning at the conferences. They get so stuck in learning mode and not doing mode. So I haven't had a certain amount of money in the bank or anything, but I do try to say, okay, if I have an idea, there's such cheap ways to get things done. If I have an idea that I know is going to grow my business, what's the most down and dirty way that I can spend $100 even to get this idea started going?
Right. The way I've done it for the past several years was to start by hiring essentially freelancers or contractors, because there's not such a commitment, and you can hire them for a few hours a week, and then you can slowly ramp them up and then, bring them on full time if needed. Is that how you've done it as well? Or did you kind of just plunk down and say, I'm hiring someone full time from the start?
Now I have people full time, now that I've been doing this for about 4 years, but I definitely started with everyone as a part time freelancer because I couldn't afford any more than that. So I've had a few people that started part-time and then have become full-time. Now I try to hire out full-time roles unless it truly is a one-time project. But even like, we just added someone new for customer service. At my company, customer service is not a full-time job. There's not enough emails for 8 hours a day, every day. So we're starting someone hourly. We'll probably move her to like flat rate part-time, assuming that all goes well. So if I can think that there's going to be enough work for them, now I do full-time. But if it's anything short of that, which it often is, I think, starting with a smaller project is the way to go.
I think the one thing that I hate about taking the leap from going directly to not having somebody work for you at all to hiring somebody full-time for a position is that you don't necessarily know how well that person is going to work out, because you know, you're in the position where you're on occasion you have to hire people who are technical, and that obviously creates some challenges, but it doesn't really matter whether you're technical or not. Hiring other people is just difficult. I mean, you can look at all the studies and research you want, and you know, even Google has tons and tons of research, which basically shows that nobody in Google knows really how to hire good people. And I'm serious about that. I mean, if you look at the things that Google has published, they say flat out, we don't know how to hire good people. They have all this statistics that they've done and tried to identify who's hired good people, who hasn't. And across the board, everyone is mediocre, which basically you can translate that out to everybody else on the planet and say, well, if nobody's good at hiring, how do you go about making sure that you do hire good people? And I think that the only way to really do it is to try people out. I mean, you have to go down that contractor or consultant route first and work with people in order to figure out whether you work well with them or not.
I think we live in a time where this is possible. And 15 years ago, I didn't know of anyone anywhere who was trying to start a business like we have, the location independent businesses with a single founder, who was able to find someone skilled who was willing to basically freelance and work part-time. And so I just think it's critical that people keep in mind as you're getting started, you don't just think in that the old mindset of I need to hire someone 40 hours a week to do something. Because Laura, the point you brought up about someone doing customer service, I agree. Even with all the businesses that I run, I still don't have a full-time customer service person. You know, it's been years that I've had these things running. So I think that's the main takeaway of kind of this first discussion point. If someone's not already thinking about the two benefits of being able to hire someone part-time is, number one, you don't have the major commitment, and number two, that you do get to try them out, like Mike said. Those would be the things I would try to take away from this.
Well, and I think a little side bonus to what you're saying that's really interesting is that you often get more entrepreneurial people, which I think is really essential for running, you know, a small, lean startup. I need everyone to be entrepreneurial thinkers, and the way to tap into this location, independent, more freedom lifestyle without starting your own business is working for another company that has that lifestyle already. Everyone who works for me works from their own home. Like, yes, they still have a somewhat boring, normal job that they have to do, but they can do it on their own hours. They can travel and do it from wherever. So I think you attract the type of people that you want in your company too.
Something else I found with contractors and consultants is that they're very much the type of person who looks at specific problems and tries to find ways to, you know, solve those problems, as opposed to when you get out, I'll say into a corporate world where people get hired and they're, you know, they know that they're getting paid to be a butt in a chair, and they will sit there, and whether they're being productive or not, they'll, you know, you're getting paid for it. So they see it as basically they're just trading off their time versus a contractor who's brought in to, you know, actually solve a problem. And that's what they're paid to do, is they're paid to solve the problem. And yes, they're getting paid for the time that they put into that problem, but their primary goal, their primary motivation is to solve those problems.
Let's move on to point two, which is to talk about the first folks that we each added to our teams, our first hire, so to speak. Laura, you want to kick us off?
Yeah. When I started, well, the business that I do now, it was just making online courses, which is a very homemade thing. I didn't need to hire a developer or anything like that. It's all very DIY. So the first person I hired was really a VA, a virtual assistant type of person who kind of helped with a little bit of everything. Customer service is something that I'm especially terrible at. So I knew that I needed someone doing that. So she did customer service. She also put emails into our email marketing program, you know, did basic tweaks and edits on WordPress website, just kind of general admin help. And she was part-time. She's a stay-at-home mom. I found that there's this huge untapped workforce. There's all these parents out there that want part-time jobs because they want to spend time with their kids, and that's not a thing in the normal workforce to have any kind of part-time job where you get to use your brain. So she was a mom looking for a part-time job. And I'll talk numbers because I know everyone always really, really wants to know. I'm pretty sure I started her out at $1,000 a month, you know, 20 hours a week-ish flat rate.
Nice.
Yeah, I think one of the first people that I hired came on as a contractor. I think I was hiring him at $1,500 a week. He actually came to me through an agency. It was more because I needed somebody there who could do scripting at the time. I mean, I kind of got away from bringing people in like that just because it was so expensive compared to what he was getting paid from the agency. So having that middleman in there really ramped up the cost. But then I switched over to using contractors. And the first contractors I found were through Odesk. What was it? I think I was only paying them $10 or $11 an hour and was able to essentially afford having them 30, 40 hours a week. And that seemed to work out pretty well. But you do have to go through interviewing process to make sure that you're getting the right people. And you need to be able to cut people loose and know that you're going to be, you're making the right decision, because it's more important to have the right people than it is to just have people working for you.
Yeah, and for me, it was a virtual assistant. This is probably 2007, I think, after I read the 4-Hour Workweek, and I was just had a couple small products that were ramping up, and I realized that doing all the support myself and all the admin tasks just wasn't the right way to go. And I hadn't even realized that you could hire people for a few hours a week around the world. And that was it was a big light that came on for me after reading that book. Hourly rate was probably $5 or $6 an hour. I think they were in the Philippines. I mean, that I don't even remember at this point, because I worked with them for a year or two and then they moved on. And I've since found a number of virtual assistants and developers and designers, like Mike said, mostly on Odesk these days. I think something for folks to think about, if you're at the point where, I guess I feel like people wait a little too long to hire that first VA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wished I had done it earlier. I think there's a longer learning curve than a lot of people think when you hire someone, because you have to learn how to be a good delegator, not to micromanage, not to throw fit if someone doesn't do it exactly the way you want it or how well you want it to be done. And so that takes time. And if you wait until the very last minute and you're totally overwhelmed and then you hire someone, then you now have this 1 to 3 month kind of learning period that is tough to do with if you have this crunch time going on. And so, but I think that hiring a virtual assistant earlier is, especially if it's variable, like I didn't hire someone for 20 or 30 hours a week. It was more of a, you know, on an as needed basis, which can be a real benefit to you if you don't have the money. I was in the situation where, you know, I didn't have a bunch of money that I wanted to spend on someone on a monthly basis.
I agree that people wait way, way, way too long. And people get really overwhelmed by what the training process is going to be like. But it's one of those things that you're just putting off the inevitable. I mean, if you want to grow your business, you're going to have to do it sooner or later. And I think it's one of the top shortcuts for making a business more successful, adding on other people. And the training is really not all the tools for screen sharing and recording what you're doing and Google Docs. I mean, just the basic stuff actually makes it, I think, a lot easier once you just force yourself to do it.
I think sometimes it's just a mental hurdle of trying to figure out what sorts of things you can hand off mm-hmm. to somebody or hire somebody for. And there's lots of things that people do on a daily basis or a weekly basis that they don't even think about, you know, sending that off to somebody else or hiring somebody to do that for them. They don't do the mental calculations of how much time, you know, it takes them to do X when they could pay somebody $10 an hour to do it for them. And they're saving themselves that much time to either spend with their family or to do other things that are going to move their business forward. I think that's the main thing that I see people doing, or the main mistake that I see, is people aren't doing those calculations to figure out where they're actually adding value to the business and where they're basically just spending time and building themselves a job.
You know, something that really hit me on that topic, this guy, Cameron Harold, who I really admire, he has a business book called Double Double. He said, go through all of your tasks and rate yourself at how good you are at them. And the highest is, let's say, E for excellence. And he said the lowest is I for incompetent. And for some reason, that really got me in my gut. I went through and I said, where am I actually incompetent at doing something? Because we do tasks that we actually are literally incompetent at. We can just barely figure out how to do them. And it really illuminates, like, why am I spending my time doing something that I'm actually incompetent at? I'm going to screw up my business.
Yeah, something that I've taken to do is about a couple times a month, I will go through my to-do list and I look at items that I've continued to push off that I have kind of a mental block against doing. And I try to figure out if I have someone on my team who can do that, or if I can hire someone to do that group of tasks. Because if I have a big chunk of them that I'm continually kind of skipping over, then I know that it's just not ideal that I actually handle them. And whether it's because I feel like I'm incompetent at them, like you said, or whether I just don't really have the desire to do them, those things sticking around on the list and not getting done typically isn't advantageous. I either hire someone or I just mark them off the list and I say, these don't need to be done. They're not important enough. And that's why I've been skipping. So we've talked about why someone should hire perhaps a virtual assistant earlier than they think. Let's talk about some of the best ways to find help, and whether that is a virtual assistant or a developer or designer. We know that traditional job boards are not going to be the source for what we're looking for, because as bootstrappers, we tend to just have to grow it slowly, organically, find people to work hourly and be flexible and work with us. So Laura, maybe you can give us some insights on how you've done it in the past, what's worked for you and what hasn't.
Odesk has already been mentioned. That's the really obvious one. But I actually didn't realize, I kind of had it in my head that Odesk was for people overseas, like a lot of people in the Philippines and in India. I was a little behind the times on my Odesk. For this customer service role, we wanted someone in America, and there are tons of Americans on Odesk, you know, working for $8 to $20 an hour. There's plenty of Americans that are super psyched to get a work from home job, a few extra hours a week, 10, 15 bucks an hour. Odesk goes way beyond even what I realized it was great for, beyond just developers, but admin people, customer service people. So I definitely love Odesk. If you're going for a true full-time person or even a true part-time person, Authentic Jobs has been amazing for me. I've found really, really good talent there. And just posting to my own network always gets good people. So posting on my social media accounts, posting to my email newsletter, we always get people that way as well.
Very nice. I had not heard of Authentic Jobs. I'm looking at it now. I will be referencing this later. Yeah, I've been an Odesk. I mean, everyone on this podcast knows that Mike and I hire a lot of people through Odesk. I've actually put together a course on hiring VAs, if anyone's curious. That's at startupvacourse.com. But I recommend Odesk throughout that. I had tried bestjobs.ph. I was on like the Manila Craigslist, Elance, Rent-A-Coder, I mean, guru.com. There were all these sites. And this is back really before Odesk came into the picture. And I tried all those and I had mixed results. And you'll still get mixed results, you know, even with Odesk. There's still a large hiring process that has to take place. But in general, I just haven't found a better source for people, especially the kind of hires we're looking for, which is, you know, kind of not a lot of hours per week and maybe some flexibility in how much they're working, as well as I just love Odesk's project management stuff, you know, with their, maybe not project management, but kind of the time tracking, the work diary aspect of it.
Well, I mean, like you, I'm still a big fan of what you can get off of Odesk, and it's primarily because you can see what people are working on and making sure that, especially if you've never met them or talked to them on the phone, you can see what they're working on and making sure that they're on track. Lately, I've actually gone down the road of hiring people through my personal network. I've got two different people right now who are working for me. One of them's putting in about 20 to 25 hours a week. Other one is putting in between 10 and 20. And both of them are hired through people I knew or friend of a friend type of thing. And they're both working out extremely well. So I think that those personal introductions, or if you know somebody, even if you just reach out to people you've worked with in the past, it seems to me like that is an exceptional way to get really, really talented people, because you already have people who are essentially vouching for their skills and vouching for their abilities as somebody who gets things done.
Oh, and I just remembered, I also have actually used Fiverr, which is kind of weird, but I've found people to do just really random tasks. Fiverr has a lot of really scammy stuff on it, but one that I did, I wanted a list of all the Facebook pages for local chamber of commerces to do Facebook ads on. So I paid someone $5. They gave me a really good list. And then recently for our blog, because design has been a hard thing for me to hire, it's one of those like where we have intermittent need, we don't have an ongoing need, but when we need it, we need it. So we don't have a designer on the team. And we had a blog post, and our editor for our blog was like, oh, it'd be really cool if we had a graphic that looked exactly like this to illustrate what we're saying in this post. And so we went to Fiverr to have someone make a graphic, and it worked out really well.
Yeah, that's a good one. I've actually used Fiverr quite a bit as well. I really like the thought of using your personal network. I don't know that I've really done that much. I think I've done it with one hire, but I have an item right now on my to-do list. I'm basically going to start looking for a marketing intern for Drip and Hittail, someone to help out with a lot of the tasks that are kind of sitting on my plate right now. My first points that I'm going to look at before I would, you know, post to Authentic Jobs or go to Odesk is I'll probably tweet it out, I'll mention it on the podcast, and see what I get from there. Because Mike, as you said, it seems like not only do you get people who maybe understand your situation a little more, but you're just more, you just have such a higher likelihood, even if you only get a couple of people who are interested, such a higher likelihood that, that they're actually going to be a fit for the position.
I think especially for an intern, it's so great to go to your network, because a fan would actually do a really great job as an intern. And my old project manager for my business, when I first hired her, I actually could not wrap my head around hiring a project manager for my business. It just seemed like an insane idea. So I kind of talked myself down and thought, okay, well, maybe I can get a project management intern, which doesn't really make sense for project management. But I put the listing out there and I got an email back from someone who had taken my courses, you know, was working on starting her own business in my community. And she said, well, I have a lot of experience in production and project management. I'm not really a typical intern, but I'd really love to learn from you and work with your company. And then she ended up becoming full-time and playing a huge role in the growth of the company.
Yeah. And that's great, because she already kind of knew your deal, right? Since you've taken your courses, she knows how you work and knows the kind of projects that you work on. I just think that's a big benefit. I think I'm going to take it in stages of like work. I'm going to work the network first. And then only if that doesn't work, then I'll explore everything else and kind of go to the masses, so to speak. I'm interested to hear, and I'm sure the listeners are too, just a brief description of kind of what your team looks like. Like, how many folks do you have working for you? Is everybody part-time, full-time? And are they distributed around the world?
Yeah, so they're distributed around the U.S. and Buenos Aires currently. So we have a full-time project manager, and that's what someone would call operations, basically runs the day-to-day of the business. We have a full-time content manager, and she also does social media, because content marketing is how I market my business. So she manages our newsletter and our blog and our internal newsletter and manages our social media posting and our social media schedule, basically our content marketing strategy. We also have a full-time developer slash tech admin. So he does everything from like writing custom WordPress plugins to the really boring stuff like loading up our emails in Infusionsoft and doing all the super boring Infusionsoft technical stuff. We also have the newest person on the team is a full-time copywriter slash data person, which is a bit of an odd combo, but it's all under that marketing umbrella. So she writes copy for blog posts, also marketing copy for emails and stuff like that. And she also does data analysis of which promotions are working. She does Facebook ads, analyzes which Facebook ads are working. Definitely in a small team, you end up with those positions where people do sort of random mishmash of stuff. And then we have part-time customer service. And next, we'll be adding on an SEO intern to help with some of our kind of overflow grunt work type of SEO tasks.
Nice. What I like about your description is you have the copywriter slash data person. And you're right, that is such a random assortment. But I've found the exact same thing, that when you're working on such a small team, that if you find someone who is good at something and you hire them for a specific thing, and you start giving them more random odds and ends, and they're good at it, and they execute and they enjoy it, then you wind up with these kind of bizarre job titles that, you know, you'd never have in a big corporate environment. But if the person is happy, they're doing good work, and it works for you and helps the company, then it's like, it's why not? There's, you know, there has to be that flexibility.
Yeah. And I'm a huge believer in the idea that whatever people love the most is where they're going to do their best work. So I'm constantly looking at what people enjoy and what they don't, and trying to give them more tasks they enjoy and see if it makes sense to move around the stuff that's not as much fun for them.
Let's talk a little bit about your hiring process, writing a job description, that kind of stuff.
So the best tip in the world, I learned this from Ramit Sethi, is to do a form that people have to fill out instead of sending in a resume. So in that form, you ask them questions related to the job. So when I was hiring a project manager, I ask her questions like, two people have this conflict, how do you handle it? You know, you need to manage scheduling this. Like, what's your strategy? What's your plan of attack? Don't let people send in resumes. Don't let people send in cover letters. They can link to a resume as one of your questions. that puts the onus on the applicant instead of putting the onus on you to dig through hundreds or thousands of resumes, which is definitely the worst and most painful part of hiring. So most people will never make it through your initial survey. So you filter out tons of people there. And then just reading the survey answers, you actually get a really good idea of who you want to talk to. So by the time you get to the interview stage, it's very few people. And I've even had positions where I've only interviewed. This is a bit unorthodox, I guess, but I've had positions where I've read the answers, interviewed just one person, felt like they were it, and then I just went ahead and hired them.
Yeah, that's a really good tip. That isn't something I've done, and I'll probably think of doing it on this round as I look for this intern. Something related, and I think, I don't remember who I took this from. I think it's probably Dan Andrews from the Lifestyle Business Podcast. I ask for a 2-minute video of them explaining, you know, I'll explain the job and then say why you're a fit, or I have a couple questions that they should answer. And it's like you said, that eliminates a lot of people in a good way, because I want someone who's willing to, you know, based on the, depending on the job, of course, if it's a developer, I may not ask for that. But if it's someone who I'm going to be interacting with and who I need, you know, maybe to be a good writer or to have certain skills, then I will absolutely ask them to, you know, sit in front of your webcam and just give me a 2-minute spiel. I will also record, typically in my job descriptions, I will link out to a video of me, like a 1-minute video of me talking about, here's who I am, get an idea of a little bit of personality, and here are some projects that I'm working on and stuff that you'll probably be involved in. And I find that, you know, some people don't like that. Some people are kind of like, well, whatever, you know, they're put off by that, but they're not a good fit for what I'm looking for.
One of the things that I find is a lot more important than the skill set is just the ability to work with somebody. And the survey questions that you talked about and, you know, the video that, Rob, you talked about, those tend to be really good for filtering out people who aren't going to be a good, for lack of a better way to put it, a cultural fit. I don't think that that's quite the term that I would probably use most of the time. But you really want to be able to find people who are going to follow directions and do exactly what it is that you want them to do, rather than go off into left field and just kind of do their own thing or do things that they think are going to be helpful but are not really in line with the vision of what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, just finding those people who can do the right thing is a lot more important than people who may spend the least amount of time doing something, but if they're not doing the things that are right or that need to be done, then it's not nearly as helpful, because then they've got to go back and do it over again, or you've got to fix it for them. And those types of things just create problems and friction. And if you can avoid those types of friction, even if you're paying a little bit more to have somebody spend more time on it, I think that you're in a much better position than to have somebody who's fantastic at a particular job but doesn't quite always do the things that need to be done, or do the error checking that needs to be handled and those types of things.
Well, I find it interesting that you bring up, why don't you like that word culture?
I don't like the word culture, because it's kind of hard, I think, to have a culture when you don't really have an office or nobody's meeting each other. I think that's more it than anything else. It's not that culture is the wrong word. It feels awkward when you're not in an office with people. Culture is not the word that I think of as a way to describe it.
I bring that up because I actually had a huge mindset shift in believing that my company does have a culture, because I used to feel like you did. And I thought, well, a culture, because when you read those articles, how to improve your company culture, they say, put a ping pong table in the break room, you know, it's going to be so much fun. And I never felt like it applied to a virtual company, but I kind of realized, you know, whatever word you like to use for it, every company does have their own, you know, your philosophy, your beliefs, how you do business, how you interact, your personality. My company does have a culture. And like you said, finding people who fit in with that culture is really, really important. I totally agree. It's even more important than their skills. And I actually took my business a lot more seriously when I thought, yeah, I do have a culture, and my culture is awesome, and my company is a great place to work. And there are a lot of people that are working jobs they don't like that would love to work for an awesome company like mine, where people are nice to each other, which is a lot more than you can say than a lot of jobs. So I actually love the idea of having a company culture and thinking about how that applies to a virtual company.
I don't think that it's wrong. It's just the word feels awkward to me. And maybe it's just the stage that I'm at, and you're, you know, a little bit more ahead of where I am mentally in that respect.
What I like about what Laura just said is basically to find the best people, you're going to need to actually do a reasonable job of selling your company in the job description. You can't just be like the old guard. You see the big, whatever, the big banks or credit card companies, and they have these job descriptions that are just horrendous. You know, you read the job posting and it's like, I feel like I'm applying to work for the government, you know, or like I'm signing up to go to prison or so. I don't know. It just, it really doesn't sound like fun. And so that's something I typically, if you've never written a job description before, I would say forget everything you have ever learned about any job you've ever applied for. Throw them out, because that is not the way that you as a bootstrapper want to hire your first, second, or third employee, you know, or freelancer. You want to convey a sense of something, that what you're doing is exciting, it's interesting, because that's how you're going to find the people that are going to jive with kind of that small company culture, or, you know, whatever word you want to use for it. So yeah, I think that's something that, that people should take away from this. Let's look at our last point, which is micromanaging. Laura, you want to talk to us about why micromanaging makes hiring pointless?
Yes, micromanaging is the worst sin of working with other people. And it's so bad because it really makes all that work that you've spent money on kind of useless, because you're just doing it again yourself. And I think most of us have been micromanaged. I remember I used to work as a designer, and I understand that attitude of, why am I going to spend a lot of time on this? You're just going to redo my work, because that's how I felt. I felt like my boss would just come and redo everything I did her own way. And you really are training your employees not to try hard because they know that you're going to come do their work over again. And it's just a huge waste of time. I've heard about people doing things like reading every email that one of their employees sends out before they're allowed to actually send it live. It's just a huge waste of time. Why would you even hire someone else to do it if you're going to take your own time to read every single thing? And most of us have been micromanaged by others, and they've trained us to be micromanagers. So I think getting rid of this habit is the key for success for running an effective team.
Yeah, there's an expression. It's building a $10,000 fence around a $1,000 piece of property. And and the idea is that you're basically misusing resources. And so if you're going to hire someone and then you're going to read all their emails before they're sent out, you're right. You shouldn't hire them. I think that for the first week or two that I hire someone, I am vigilant, you know, about what they're doing. I mean, you have to make sure things are going right. It's obvious that if you have that much of a need for control, then either you're not ready to hire someone, or you have some really bad habits that you have to unlearn before you're going to be ready to do so.
I think one of the biggest things is trust. A lot of people struggle with, how much do you trust your employees? How much do you trust your freelancers? And it's definitely something everyone has to figure out for themselves, with what you feel comfortable with. I err on an immense amount of trust. I figure if people are going to steal from me or screw things up on purpose, I obviously did such a poor job of predicting that. It would be totally unexpected if that were to ever happen. So to base everything around hedging for that not happening, I would just rather give people full trust from the beginning, and it allows them to do better work.
Part of that is your trust in yourself that you made a good hiring decision, because you have to, you know, just accept that you made this hiring decision and you're putting them in charge of things so that you don't have to be that person making those decisions. I mean, that's what you hired them for, is you hired somebody to make decisions on your behalf, and you need to trust yourself that you made a good hiring decision, that they're going to make the right decisions. And there's going to be occasions where they don't make the same decision that you would have. It doesn't mean that it's wrong or that you need to go through and redo their work. I mean, what you really need to do is make a conscious effort to never go back and redo somebody's work, because I think that just creates some sort of friction between you and the person you hired, because they will get to a point where they say, well, everything I do, my manager is just going to redo it anyway, so why should I bother to do a good job?
Mike, I think that is so important. I think that's really the key. What you said, that they are going to make different decisions than you're going to make. I think that's why a lot of good people go bad in hiring. That's why a lot of good people micromanage, because they say they're willing to let go, but they still want everything to be their preference. And your way is not the only right way. that's why you hired someone else. So I think seeing that difference between, okay, what's really important to you? What's a real guiding value and philosophy and strategy of how you want to run your company versus what's just your personal preference that actually doesn't matter so much? And someone else's personal preference is just fine. Just let them do it.
So to recap, we've covered how to hire like a bootstrapper today. And the first thing we talked about was how hiring and outsourcing is different for a bootstrap startup. Then we talked about the first folks we'd added to our team. And next we talked about the best sources that we've used to find help, the websites that we've used. Fourth, we talked about the hiring process and a little bit about writing a job description. And then lastly, we touched on micromanaging. So Laura, if people want to get in touch with you, where would be the best place for that?
You can find me on Twitter as LKR or find me at lkrsocialmedia.com.
So yeah, Laura, thanks again for taking the time to come on the podcast and help share your experience of hiring like a bootstrapper.
No, that was fun. Thanks for having me as a guest.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.